My name is Tommy Andrews and welcome to the SoundSpring podcast. This is the place where creative musicians share the ways in which they turn their stories, ideas, and feelings into sound. During each episode, my guest composers will take you on a guided journey through one of their musical works. This is music, straight from the source. This episode is the first half of a conversation I had with writer, speaker, and coach, Dr. Mandy Leto. We'll be discussing how we can make 2021 our most creative and productive year to date. Mandy spends much of her time empowering people with the tools and courage to live their lives with more purpose and authenticity. So if you're dreaming big for next year, this is the episode for you. Mandy's work has featured in the Sunday Times, Psychology Today, The Huffington Post, eFinancial News, Top Sante, and CNBC. She also writes columns for Psychology's magazine and hosts her own podcast, The Moxiecast. As a speaker, she gets invited to some of the world's biggest corporations and institutions, such as IBM, Lloyd's of London, Rothschild, Bulgari, Nestle, Citi, and the London School of Economics. And, if that wasn't enough, she is also in the process of completing a memoir. I met Mandy around 11 years ago when I started teaching her two children clarinet and saxophone. Musicianship and creativity run deep in her blood, as her eldest just gained a place at a top London conservatoire and her youngest is thriving at the junior department of another of London's top conservatoires. I challenge you to name me a more inspiring, kind, and genuine soul. So it's with my great pleasure that we can start 2021 in the wholesome presence of Dr. Mandy Leto. Mandy, welcome to the SoundSpring podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. It's a real honor and I can't wait to discuss some of the things we've got planned for today. So thank you.
Me too. This is going to be something a little bit different for me. So you're going to pull out different sides of my personality. So I'm looking forward to this.
That's the plan. So for listeners who are used to the usual format of this podcast, where we go through a piece of music and discuss some of the creative aspects of the music, for this episode, we're going to be taking a slightly different approach. And Mandy and I are going to be discussing how we can make some creative resolutions in the new year and use some of these tips regarding productivity to get our projects done. So firstly, can you quickly share with us how you ended up transitioning into your current role as a writer, speaker, and coach?
Well, I think it's more about coming full circle. I always intended to be a creative. I spent most of my childhood sitting in my closet writing poetry, little mini novels, anything you could imagine. I drew it, I wrote it. So I think I was a creative anyway, from the time I was little. We're all creative. And I think that when I grew up, I somehow, and I can't remember where it actually, where the crossroads came that, you know, I have to drop this being a creative because I'll never be able to make it and I'll be living on beans on toast. But somewhere along the way, it went into my head that I had to have a, now I'm doing air quotes here, serious profession. So I ended up going through my uni degree and had every intention to become a professor of history. So I got a PhD in history and then started looking for professorships all over the world. And when you're just coming out of uni, it's really tricky to land a full-on professorship. And I ended up going into investment banking. So I did that for several years and climbed the ranks of investment banking like a Navy SEAL, got to where I felt pretty okay. And then I thought, I don't have enough love for this to do what it takes to get to the next level. So I had a small baby at that stage and a little toddler at home, and the maternity leave was just that time I needed to think. And I made the decision one day after mulling it over that I was going to come back to my creative roots and start writing the book that I never wrote, come back and be in that relational space between people where amazing stuff happens when two people have a conversation. I love the in the momentness of that, because that's actually where all possibility lives. So I think for me, it was more of a coming home, as opposed, like, I meandered around to see if there was anything greener on the other side of the fence. And I ended up coming back home to the creative world.
So musically, there are lots of things that we can do as composers where we can take the listener further and further and further away from the place where they feel comfortable musically. So, you know, if we're starting in a home key, we can take them further and further away. And the more we kind of delay the expectation of that return to where they feel comfortable, the more powerful that return feels at the end of the piece. Do you think that when you did come full circle, because you'd gone on quite a detour, do you think it felt even more powerful? Do you think your hunger was even more to get back into it than maybe it would have been if you'd gone straight into it to start with?
The funny thing is, I think I doubted myself all the more because I kept telling myself, oh, I'm too old. That ship has sailed. I haven't done creative stuff for such a long time. I'm rusted beyond repair. All of these inner gremlins, which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit today, but wow, they gathered friends as I was meandering. There was a whole big tribe of them. So as much as I would love to say, Tommy, yes, I just got over to my computer and it all poured out of me. No, that's not actually how it worked out at all.
Does music play a part in your history anywhere along the line?
I grew up in an extremely musical family. My mother was and still is a singer. She sang all day long. She sang to us all day long, anywhere from old Finnish folk tunes to Beatles tunes. And so that I had a really rich musical childhood. My father also was quite musical. He played the accordion. The accordion is big in our family growing up in Northern Ontario in Canada, where there was a very large Finnish population. And apparently Finland, and I think it might be Argentina, have like the biggest accordion tango populations on the planet. And my brother trained with the world accordion championist, and he still plays accordion. My brother plays guitar, and I'm the smart one. Yeah, so there's a story there, but maybe that's for another time. But we were definitely a very, very musical family. But the truth is, I don't even read music.
So New Year is often a point where a lot of people will be gearing themselves up for tackling their big dreams over the coming year. Are there any pitfalls that, in your experience, we should maybe try and avoid right at the outset?
I would say resolutions. That would be what I would avoid. The thing is, when we make a resolution, we're making something that is so, you know, it's unfurling, it's organic, it wants to be born, it wants to be played with. And what we're trying to do with a resolution is too quickly box it into, this is what you're supposed to look like, and you're supposed to happen within 6 weeks, and it's going to be this rigorous, regimented journey that, in for my creative projects anyway, just doesn't unfold like that. I can't tell you how many times I have put a routine on myself to say, I'm now going to finish this book by the 7th of July this year. And I've just come to realize that as long as you keep showing up, it takes as long as it takes, because that's the nature of a creative project. I mean, maybe it's different if you're wanting to get a six pack or, you know, something along those lines. But I think for creative projects, it's really a commitment to continue to show up, even if there's nothing that's coming that day. Even if you're sitting at the, if I'm writing, for example, I'll use a lot of writing examples, but that's kind of my musical equivalent, is I'll sit at the page and I'll put my timer on, and all I need to do is type repeatedly, I have nothing to say, I have nothing to say, I have nothing to say. You fill half a page with I have nothing to says, and then guess what? A sentence shows up. And it might be that I wipe all of those things off the following day, that there was nothing usable there, but that's not the point. So instead of a resolution, I'm making a resolution to show up. regardless of what happens, what alchemy, what magic happens in that moment, my commitment is to get my butt in that chair at that time. And more often than not, something shows up.
Creativity also, it doesn't have to be artistic. So how can everyone introduce a little bit more creativity into their everyday lives outside of their projects?
I think that our creative projects are a sort of a signal of how we live. So I think the answer to that for me anyway is living from a place of curiosity. It's one of the biggest, most devastating things that our brain does this automation thing, which is good on many fronts, to be able to take a process and just to make it that we know how this story ends. We know how this goes. We know what the outcome is, to try to save all those steps. And it kind of makes grooves within the brain that we think faster. But on the other hand, it really means that we skip out on being open and having that kind of childlike wonder and just playing with being in the moment and walking a different way to work, reading a different book, reading a magazine you wouldn't normally read, listening to a kind of music you wouldn't normally listen to. You know, we tend to get very same-ish about things. We eat the same ice cream, we drink the same wine, we eat the same dinners, we get in these ruts. And I think when we're willing to bring more curiosity into our lives, it has this way of showing up in our creative work as well. So I think for me, it's very much an approach to living as opposed to this is my day-to-day life over here and this is my creative life. And I think the bridge between those things is curiosity.
One of your mottos is that inspiration is a muscle. And I like the twist on this because the traditional view and the traditional thing we hear a lot is that creativity is a muscle. So can you take us into what you mean by this and how can we use this motto to start igniting some exciting ideas?
So one of the things I think people often do is they wait for inspiration to begin a creative project. Or they wait to feel it. Also, the same thing works for confidence. I'm going to wait to begin this project until I feel confident. But that's kind of like waiting until you feel strong to go to the gym. It doesn't work like that. So inspiration and confidence, they're not prerequisites. They're the results of taking action. And when we start to take action, we start to feel more confident. We start to feel more self-esteem. We start to feel more inspiration. So it's a state that I think we can learn to put ourselves into, again, by putting more creativity into our lives, putting more curiosity into our daily processes. So it's something that we can come at it instead of waiting for it. So don't wait for inspiration to strike. I can't remember who said it, but there's one author who said inspiration's for amateurs.
For me, I think it also helps to think about the etymology of the word inspire or inspiration, which just comes, I think, from the Greek and Latin to breathe. And it just makes the whole process a bit easier because I just imagine myself breathing in as much as I can, whether it's music or art or poetry or nature. It just means that I don't necessarily have to be trying so much all the time.
I believe that if we make a practice of regularly having something to marvel at, and that doesn't need to be anything extraordinary, although it can be, but getting into that's another piece that I hadn't quite articulated it before, but being in a state of curiosity more of the time, cultivating that habit. And it's a practice I learned from a woman that I've done some work with. She's an author. She's written a beautiful book called On Being Human, a woman called Jen Pasteloff. And she has this practice called beauty hunting, where you could just be taking a walk or, you know, you're standing there brushing your teeth in the morning and staring out the window, looking at the sunrise. And it's just spending some time in your day noticing the beauty around us, because so often we're in our to-do lists or even in our projects, you know, and oh, I didn't get that bit done. Oh, I still need to work on that. That we're out of this moment, which is in the now. And I think when we marvel at something, when we're in a place of curiosity, we can't be worrying about what we didn't get done that day or worrying about how much we're going to have to do tomorrow. It forces us to be in this moment. And in this moment is the only place where art of any kind can ever happen. And I think most of our lives, we're not even in there. We're either ruminating or, you know, mulling something over or projecting. And I think these are practices that can keep us anchored in this moment more of the time.
Do you find that since having children, that has become even more apparent? Because watching, I mean, for me, when I watch my kids go about their daily lives, just completely full of wonder and curiosity, it really helps me ground myself, I think.
Absolutely. I think kids can be wonderful teachers about how we stay in that place of curiosity and also in a place of play. I think this is hugely important for creating anything in this world. Is they have outcome apathy. You know, they're not attached to something has to look a certain way. They're in the moment. They're playing with the moment. They're finding something to marvel at. They're being in the joy of that moment. And I think, yeah, kids are wonderful teachers for sure.
I'm just, for the record, not suggesting that all listeners should just go out and have children just so that their creative projects start seeing positive results. I thought what we do now is use our imaginations and pretend that we are embarking on our absolute dream project. A few weeks ago, I asked if any of my listeners had some questions about creative processes or getting their projects done. And there's a few questions that maybe I've encountered during my time putting together some projects as well. So here we go. I was wondering whether you feel like you've ever had to check in to see whether you're embarking on one of these projects for the right reasons. For example, it could be that maybe there's something niggling at the back of your head saying, like, am I doing this to serve someone else or please someone else? And have you experienced this, and how can we go about sort of making sure that maybe we're doing something for the right reasons?
Oh, that is such a juicy question. I think I've always been pretty headstrong. I think in the past, because I grew up in a very rural town and ended up moving to the big city and thinking that I had to be a certain way to be accepted, I think that probably made me status driven for a time. In other words, that I have to produce a certain type of work, or it has to be of a certain standard, or it has to be serious. I think that that probably took me on a path. But then I think at some stage I realized that I was drifting away from what my real zone of genius was, which is bringing this little bit of personality to certain. So, I mean, I can write something in a very technical way, but it's when we infuse it with our personality. So I think I'd never drifted too far from that, but I've definitely known a lot of people who have, you know, even embarked on careers or ended up in relationships or what have you, because their parents thought they should, or, for example. But I think that's one thing I've been really grateful for, is I've always had a really strong inner compass, and I've drifted occasionally, but I think I've always managed to come around to it again.
One listener wanted to hear your thoughts on self-worth and valuing our ideas, and whether if we as a creative are not so, if we're not so hot on sort of backing our own ideas, how can we start cooking up some more positivity, creating a bit of a positive feedback loop about ourselves and our ideas and what we want to do?
Oh, this question is so front of mind to me at the moment. I just had a really powerful conversation with a compassion and mindfulness teacher, a woman called Catherine Kell. And she really educated me on this. And it's really left a mark in a positive way. This goes back to what I was saying earlier, that often we wait for confidence to take on a project or to see a project through. And because we don't have it, we're tentative with the creativity in the meantime, or we play it safe instead of really letting rip, because we have our own clamps on, you know, the way a car gets clamped. We clamp ourselves because we want to play it safe, because we don't want to be criticized. And we wait for self-esteem, or we wait for confidence to be able to unclamp ourselves. But what I learned is that instead of seeking confidence or self-esteem to be able to move ourselves forward, to feel worthy, to feel good enough in a project. Instead, what I would really suggest that all of us begin to cultivate, myself included, is self-compassion. Because self-esteem is evaluative, meaning that we will compare ourselves to somebody else's composition, somebody else's piece of writing, somebody else's piece of art. And we'll always find ways to be like, wah, wah, that we're not as good as they are. And we're comparing our first attempt at maybe somebody's 65th attempt. We don't see what's happened behind the scenes for them to come up with this finished project. So self-esteem, if we're waiting for self-esteem to determine our worth that way, what experts on this say is that self-esteem is our fair weather friend. It's there as long as we are winning in that evaluative comparison. But as soon as we lose that, when someone's better than we are, our self-worth plummets and we go down that downward spiral of feeling bad about ourselves, feeling hopeless, talking negatively to ourselves. And the thing is, this is just like being on a roller coaster emotionally. And depending on, are we better than others or not, depending on what group of people we hang out with and whether or not we're willing to outgrow that group of people to take ourselves creatively to the next level. So instead, is cultivating this practice of being compassionate with ourselves, because that's not evaluative, regardless of whether the piece that we create sucks or people point and laugh or whether we just never finish it. Our worth is untouched by that, that it's just foundationally always there. And the practice that Catherine taught me on this that was really, really powerful is, first of all, notice when you're in that place of contraction or talking unpleasantly to yourself or comparing yourself to somebody else. And just notice what you're feeling. You don't have to say this out loud. You can journal it if you want, but you can simply be in the moment and think like, I'm really feeling low self-worth at the moment, or I'm feeling pretty hopeless, or I'm feeling like this will never be good enough. I'm hurting, I'm suffering, and what have you. And then the second step is to realize that other people feel like this all the time. There's people around the world who, artists around the world, creators who are sitting there face-palming, thinking, oh, this will never work. It's not as good as so-and-so. So understanding that this is part of the human condition. Every creator has felt like this. Every creator will feel like this. So there's something about the not aloneness there that gets us out of our, I'm the only one who feels like this in my dark place. And then the third step is really about, how can I give myself some kindness in this moment? Like, maybe I need a cup of tea or a glass of wine, or I need to do a headstand for 5 minutes or stretch or ride my bike or what have you, or take a nap or try again tomorrow. So this would be the one practice that I think would really benefit any creative person in 2021, is really building your self-compassion muscles big time.
If we have quite a large number of goals, not just sort of one big thing, we're actually thinking about lots of bitty things, how do we go about finding a way of tackling all of those things without them seeming like one big, giant, insurmountable task that we've got ahead of us?
I don't know if it works like this for you, Tommy, but often I found if I have lots of bitty goals, if I simply kind of mind map them all on, take the kitchen table and fill it with paper and take out all my colored pencils and think, this is what this project entails. Often I can see things by putting it on paper that I wouldn't normally see. And then if I see which project makes me feel most alive, what's most alive to me in this moment, what is the project that really wants to be born? Often there's some kind of connective tissue between that and many of those other satellite projects. And then there might be some completely random one over on the side. And if I'm feeling no heartbeat on that whatsoever, that one might get put on mothballs temporarily, or it might just disappear. But there's usually some kind of constellation of projects when I look at them, when I get them out of my head and I put them on paper and I stand there and I look at them from a different perspective. There's something about the act of getting them out of my head where they're all swirling around and seeing them on paper and then just being with what feels most alive. That's kind of an abstract answer, but that's actually how it works for me.
Let's take the opposite thing. if we're dreaming really, really big, and instead of all these satellite projects, we've just got this big elephant on the table in front of us, how do we prevent that from overwhelming us, and how do we start chipping away at those kind of things?
This is possibly my most favorite ever thing to do, which is what I do with people in coaching all the time. And I learned this from my mentor, who said, dream bigger than you've ever dreamed and take tinier steps. So the steps that you take need to be so stupidly small that there's something about the way that we generate motion, and an object in motion tends to stay in motion. So if we make the leap required to create motion too big, then it's very, very easy to create excuses and say, oh, I can't today, I'm too busy, you know, need to shampoo the cat and clean the cutlery drawer, can't, you know, it's setting ourselves up to win by making the goal so small for that day that, you know, I started to try to get fit again after being really down with burnout for a couple of years. So instead of like, I'm going to get a personal trainer and rock it 3 times a week for an hour, I started by doing one push-up. And, you know, you might say, well, what's that going to do? Well, cumulatively, I get to a stage where I can do 6, and then I could do 10, and I could do 20. And then I stopped again for whatever reason. And then I had to start again. So it's this slow and steady. And remember, a creative project takes whatever time it takes, because it doesn't entirely belong to us. It's coming through us. So what we're doing is we're creating the smallest amount of space not to spook ourselves, and understanding that we're fallible and we will start and stop. And if we make it small, we're much more likely to do one push-up or write one word or open your composition software and sit there and just stare at it for 5 minutes. If that's what all you did on day one, woohoo, brilliant. So Jerry Seinfeld used to have this practice, apparently, that he would write a joke a day, and then he would get a chain going. So every time he had written a joke, he would put a red X on his paper calendar. And once you get a chain going, you don't want to break the chain as well. So if you simply open your composition software, whatever that might be, or you open your notebook or you open your laptop to a Word document for the book you're going to write, maybe that's all you need to do for the first days. You sat there for 5 minutes and looked at it. Great. You put your red X on the calendar, and then you just keep going and going and going. So I think we're taking all the pressure out of it and the kind of performance anxiety and the intensity out of it. I don't think it helps in that nascent state of the creative project.
Another thing I quite like, which is pretty much along the same lines, but if you've got a to-do list or a creative to-do list that has all these really hardcore things on it, I quite like to intersperse those, just add in these little ones that I know I can definitely win. You know, it could be anything. It could be something really, really small. If you add those into your to-do list for the day, especially at the beginning of the day, and you make those first few little mind battles like really easy to win, then again, you're getting the ball rolling. You're in momentum. You're starting off with some ticks, and it makes the whole day just feel a lot easier, I think, rather than starting with your to-do list saying like, write a novel.
Exactly. I think these things are far too big. So if you thought about, if you want to write a novel, maybe your task for the day is make a Word document, and then you're done. Anything else on top of that is over and above. And I think once we get going, often we want to feel the dopamine hit of having a win. So when we have the win, we're much more likely to do a second push-up or write a second sentence. And this is something that I loved. Apparently, I don't even know if it's true, but apparently Hemingway used to always, when he was finished writing for the day, he would stop mid-sentence. So when he opened the document again the next day or sat at his typewriter, he always had somewhere to begin from, as opposed to, you know, having to kind of get the turbines going again. So that might be a fun thing to do too. Stop in the middle of a musical phrase, for example.
Yeah, that's a really nice one. I'm definitely going to try that. Another listener was wondering whether you'd had any experience dealing with ideas maybe starting to get so carried away that we maybe then lose sight of the reason why we've had that idea or why we want to do something. So, for example, you've come up with an idea that you want to do some kind of project and then your mind just goes in all these different directions and you're like, oh, I could add this, I could do this, I could do this. And suddenly you feel a million miles away from that really lovely little nucleus idea of why you wanted to do it in the first place.
I think that two things can be at play here. Either we're in a place of procrastination and we're trying to keep all our options open so as not to shut off any. And that's okay. And I think everybody will have a way of, they'll have a sort of spidey sense of whether or not they're truly in a place of procrastination or whether this is a place of percolation. Sometimes there is this, I certainly have to sort of sit there, particularly around structure. Sometimes it takes me a long time and I meander into all sorts of different places. And then all of a sudden it just clicks into place. Does that look like procrastination? Maybe. But I think I have a way of telling whether I'm trying to evade the work. And then I head straight away back to my very well-thumbed copy of Stephen Pressfield's War of Art and his book, Going Pro. And those usually set me straight pretty quickly. I even just open a random page and, you know, I always get what I need from Mr. Pressfield. So I think my advice there would be, don't beat yourself up. Just check in. Am I percolating or am I procrastinating? And if I'm procrastinating, maybe the step is too big. How could I make the step smaller? Or equally, could I talk to somebody else? And in explaining it, this is the coach and me talking, there's something beautiful that happens when we're having a conversation and the other person listens and holds space powerfully. Often you might come to your own conclusion. Maybe it's, again, just that it's swirling in your head. So those would be my two points that I'd offer there.
One thing I think we both share, for me, one of my personal creative kryptonites is that I quite often wait until something is perfect before I allow others to see it, or I wait until I'm in kind of a perfect position before launching something. A bit like you said, being strong before you go to the gym. And you quite regularly title yourself as a recovering overachiever. So I was wondering, how have you managed to start letting go and maybe start sharing some of your things in a more raw state?
One of the books that has changed my life that I would recommend that everybody pick up for themselves straight away is Austin Kleon's book, Share Your Work. And he has this page, he does it all, squiggles with Sharpies, and he kind of cartoons the book. So I love the look of it as well. It's like a work in progress. And it just permissioned me to start showing things before they were ready, because it can form a dialogue that would give me new ideas before I had like set everything in concrete. This is now the finished product, that it can sometimes become more co-creative process if I show it to somebody and they say, oh, how about this? How about this? The whole point of art for me, and I say that caps lock, capital A art, is connection. It's connection. It's sharing my ideas with somebody and seeing how they interact. I think people are not often looking for perfection. They're looking for connection. And at least that's what I'm looking for. So I realized that when I created something that got to my level of almost perfect, it had lost something. It had become really rigid and starchy. And it's not about it being technically perfect. I think that was what I was always aiming for, that it had to be technically perfect. But then when you look at mixing genres, like if I listen to music, I listen to jazz music all the time. There's jazz playing in this house all the time. If you listen to Billie Holiday singing a jazz piece, her voice is not technically perfect, but you know, I defy anybody to sit there and listen to one of her pieces undistracted and not be moved to tears. So I think maybe it's getting older as well, and maybe some wisdom is seeping in, but realizing that the true beauty of the art that seeks to come through me is that there is some technical, you know, there is some nod to the technical aspects of it. So writing has to be good writing, for example. But on the other hand, it's the way you flavor it. It's the way that you bring your own interpretation, the way that for me right now matters way more than is this by the book perfect. And it's just more interesting. This is what I'm drawn to if I come from that place of curiosity. Share your work, let it connect with other people.
I hope you enjoyed the first part of my conversation with Mandy. She will be back on the 12th of January to guide us through some of the challenges we might face whilst on our next creative quest. As for our next musical guest, I'm so excited to be welcoming the enchanting and enthralling songstress Daisy Chute to the show on Tuesday the 5th of January. Daisy and I will be delving into her heart-wrenching song Troubadour Boy, a ballad exploring sacrifice and unrequited love. Keep your box of tissues handy as it's an absolute tearjerker. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to keep in touch, visit us at soundspring.co.uk. You can connect with us on Instagram by searching for Soundspring Pod, or you can send us an email at soundspringpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. If you like what you've heard, please spread the word and don't forget to give us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. It really helps us to reach new listeners. If you enjoy the show and want to support our podcast, you can donate or become a patron of the show at patreon.com/soundspringpodcast. Obviously, we encourage you to go and buy our guests' music. But once you've done that, and only once you've done that, you can also stream most of the music featured in the show by searching for the Soundspring podcast playlist in Spotify. And finally, I'd like to thank Katie Stevenson for her beautiful artwork. Please go and follow her work on social media by searching for Cub and Bloom. This is Tommy Andrews, signing off until next time.